Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett.
No, you're not. You're Preston.
As we mentioned in a previous conversation with Dan Vogel, Joseph's vision was similar to Methodist visions of the day. He questions whether a Methodist would have really reacted so strongly against Joseph's first vision account. So we're going to weigh in on that issue with Dr. Stephen Harper, author of First Vision, Memory, and Mormon Origins. It's a great book. So anyway, check out our conversation.
Well, and I wonder about this other issue is, you know, Methodists were known for having visions.
Sure.
And so it seems a little strange that a Methodist minister would reject Joseph. Could have been a Presbyterian minister, because they weren't as into ecstatic religious experiences, were they?
You're right about that, but it's probably a Methodist minister. I don't think Joseph's mistaken about that. Let me give you a potential interpretation of the facts that makes sense of. So right now you're feeling like there's incongruity in Joseph's story. If he had reported a vision
to a
Methodist
minister. Well, I'm trying to give Dan's view.
Yeah, right. that's what he's saying, exactly. This is fun for me. I'm having a great time.
That is good.
Hope you are too.
I hope Dan's watching.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Here are the facts. The facts are Methodists are active in the area. Joseph Smith says that he is partial to Methodism, has some desire to be united with them. He tells Alexander Niebuhr that he attends Methodist meeting and wants to feel and shout like the rest. He wants ecstatic religion. He wants to be overwhelmed by the Holy Spirit. A vision would be great, right? Something that would confirm to him that the Presbyterian God of John Calvin, the angry God who abhors him and is already in his sovereign will destined him to hell, most likely, is not the real God.
Wasn't it a Presbyterian that said Alvin was going to go to hell?
Yes, the Reverend Benjamin Stockton.
Okay.
Exactly. You got it.
And Joseph Smith Sr. wasn't very happy about that.
No, because it just doesn't, it's not very satisfying.
Yeah, well, no wonder Joseph didn't like the Presbyterians.
Yeah, right. So Joseph is inclined by heart to Methodism, where you can do something about it, right? You're still saved by the grace of God. You're still redeemed by Jesus Christ, but he endows you with the gift of his grace that enables you to come to him. Whereas in the Presbyterian teaching of the time, God has made the decision of your salvation or damnation by his arbitrary sovereign will, and there's nothing you can do about it. Joseph feels like in his head, that's probably right. Because I've been convicted of my sins, and try as I might, nothing I do seems to matter. But in his heart, he holds on to the hope that the Methodists are right. He prefers that soteriology, that doctrine of salvation. Okay, so this in mind, Joseph is not attuned to the fine points of debate, even inside the Methodist clergy. He doesn't know, as a later author put it, that orthodoxy became methodized, and then Methodism became orthodoxed. In other words, he's not aware of what the Methodist ministers are aware of, and that means that he thinks that going into the woods and having a vision is evidence of a Methodist conversion. It finally worked. The Methodists told me that might work. It was a Methodist minister who said, if you lack wisdom, ask God. Right? I did everything they said, and I tried it before, and it never worked, and finally it worked. So Joseph's initial interpretation of his experience is, I have now a Methodist conversion. What you do in that case is you report it to the minister. You get validated. And he's shocked when he gets anything but validated. And so that's the point, right? You're saying, well, wouldn't a Methodist minister say, yeah, that was a great vision you had? Not necessarily.
Well, that's what Dan would say. Yes.
Right. Think about reasons why that might not be the default response. This Methodist minister may be aware that Methodism is trending toward enthusiasm, right? Which is not a positive term in those days. That means to be crazy, right? Or it's beginning to be. And there are some in the Methodist ministry who are trying to pull back from that over-enthusiastic response, right? Lorenzo Dow is still going, and he's still working people into frenzy. But some of the Methodist clergy are saying, oh, that's just a little too weird for me, right? It's also the case that John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, has prophesied, look, we're going to grow like gangbusters, and the risk we run is becoming formalists, right? We might grow exponentially and get to a point where we're like everybody else, where we speak of God with our mouths, but we deny the power thereof. We have a form of godliness, but we deny his power. Don't ever do that, John Wesley says. So let's say you're a Methodist minister, and you've been influential in getting this feeling among the people that they can come to Christ. And it's all good until you see maybe some people getting a little excessive for your comfort level, maybe going a little too far. And then one of them comes to you and says, guess what? It worked. I saw God in Christ in the woods. And guess what they said? Everybody here, including you, sir, have a form of godliness, but you deny the power thereof. That's the cue for the Methodist minister to say.
You think that's what Joseph Smith said to a
I don't know. Nobody knows. But it's possible, right? You see, what I'm saying here is there are alternative ways to interpret the facts. So the way that has Joseph Smith being unreliable, that's one interpretation, but it's not the only one. It's not the only credible one. It's not the only one you can make if you're smart and the other ones are dumb. There are believing ways to understand Joseph that fit perfectly well with his time and place. He doesn't have to be impeached as anachronistic or unreliable as a rememberer. And nobody can verify it, right? It can be offered as an alternative. Nobody can verify my interpretation either. So all we can do is read the facts and interpret them in the best way we can, with the most context. And we either do that with a believing bias or an unbelieving bias, neither of which make us necessarily more intelligent or better at interpreting the facts. So what I want people to understand is that you don't have to default to my interpretation or Dan Taves' or Ann Vogel's or whatever. Read the evidence yourself and come to your own conclusions. And don't let people who think we're smart, like myself, make you feel like you're dumb. You're smart enough to make your own judgments about these things. Learn the facts. The facts are more easily accessible than they've ever been before. Listen to what Joseph says. Read all his accounts. Learn as much as you can about the context. Don't take Wesley Walter's word for the context or Milton Bachman's just by default, right? Read it all.
Now, is there a place where you can actually... But I was just thinking of this yesterday. Somebody should write a book where you've got the 1835 account, the 1832, 1835, 1838, 1842. So you can kind of look at them side by side. You've done that?
Yeah, and the best place, I wrote a little book for Deseret called Joseph Smith's First Vision, a Secret, a Guide.
And it actually has the Seeker's Guide to the Accounts. Like the transcript of what he said?
Yeah, all of them are transcribed. Better place to go, though, is Joseph Smith Papers' website, right? They've got the images there. They've got the transcriptions there. And James Allen's article, really, he was a pioneer. It was 1970 or 71 when he published in the Improvement Era an article called Eight Accounts of Joseph's Vision, What We Can Learn From Them. I think that's the title or something close
to it. Yeah, because there were four that were essentially either written or commissioned by Joseph.
Right.
And then we have...
Five now that we know of.
Five?
That were contemporary, right.
So we've got 1832, 1835, 1838, 1842.
Yep. What am I missing? Then you've got Orson Pratt. No, so five contemporary accounts. You've got the four primary accounts right there.
Those are the four primary accounts. Okay.
And then Orson Pratt, Orson Hyde, Levi Richards, David White, and Alexander Niebuhr all created accounts of the vision that they heard Joseph give during his lifetime.
Okay. Okay, so there's basically 9 accounts
so far, and it depends.
Contemporary accounts.
You know, yeah, there's a 14 November 1835 entry in Joseph's journal where he says, "I told Erastus Holmes about my vision of angels." Some people say there's an account of the vision. Some people say, no, that's just him telling he gave an account of the vision, but it doesn't actually record any details. So you can hear different people say there's 5 primary accounts or 4, or you know, they'll do the same thing with the secondary ones. But generally speaking, the Joseph Smith papers, for example, said there are 9 accounts, 4 primary ones, 5 secondary ones, and here they are.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Stephen Harper. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about the year 1838 and the things going on and the settings around Joseph Smith's writing of the 1838 First Vision account.
So in 1838, let's talk about what all the things were going on. So that's when he got kicked out of Kirtland.
Yeah, right? So they start that account.
Yeah,
the bank. They start that account after he's driven from Ohio, leaves Ohio in the dead of the night, flees out of there, quite worried about how things are going to go, and arrives in Missouri just in time for things to fall out there.
Yeah.
So he starts that document.
Because Hans Mill was that same year as well.
That fall, exactly.
So that was quite a year. You got Hans Mill at the end.
Year of his life.
You got the bank crisis at the beginning.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button, or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I've probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.